Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. Mood disorders like anxiety and depression affect about 10% of adults in any given year and almost 15% of adolescents aged 13 through 18. At some point in our lives, nearly 40% of us will experience some type of diagnosable mood disorder, and nearly all of us will have a family member or close friend who struggles with anxiety or depression. Depression is the leading cause of disability in the United States, and a staggering 10 to 15% of clinically depressed patients die by suicide. In his groundbreaking book, Feeling Good, psychiatrist Dr. David Burns highlights how our automatic negative thoughts, cultivated by years of practice, cause nearly all depressive episodes. How do we develop these automatic negative thoughts, and what can we do to change our internal dialogue, elevate our self-esteem, increase motivation, and improve the quality of our lives? On today's program, Dr. David Burns joins us to answer these questions and to share his approach to treating mood disorders. Dr. Burns received his medical degree from Stanford University, completed his psychiatric residency at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, and is currently an adjunct clinical professor emeritus of psychiatry at Stanford University. Dr. Burns has authored 11 books on the treatment of mood disorders, and his book, Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy, has sold over 6 million copies worldwide. Feeling Good is the most frequently recommended book for depressed patients by mental health professionals in the United States and Canada. Welcome to Line One, Dr. Burns. I really do appreciate you taking the time to join me today.
Thanks so much. It's an honor and a treat to be on your program.
Oh, yes, for us as well. I want to encourage listeners to take this opportunity to call in or email any questions you might have on today's topic. We have at our disposal one of the world's leading experts on the treatment of mood disorders. So please take advantage of this unique opportunity. If you have a question about depression or anxiety for Dr. Burns, give us a call, drop a question, and I'm sure he can give us an excellent answer. As always, you can reach us in one of three ways. Our local phone number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, you can reach us on our toll-free number. That's 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to reach us is to email your comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. If you've never emailed us before, you got to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. All right, Dr. Burns, I saw you speak at the Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference in Anaheim, along with many of your colleagues, and it was some really good information, and of course, I got very excited and decided I needed to pick your brain and see if I could get you on the air, so I'm really excited to have you.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I'm psyched also.
Okay, I guess let's start off, since this seems to be, Feeling Good was written when? When was it?
It came out in 1980.
So that's quite a while. It seems to be kind of your life's work is helping people with mood disorders. Can you talk about just briefly the prevalence of mood disorders in our culture and
why?
Well,
it depends kind of how you define it. I have developed really brief, accurate tests for depression and anxiety, and you know, we could kind of ask the listeners right now, like, you know, are you feeling down and blue? Do you sometimes feel, you know, inferior or worthless, or like you're not as good as you should be? Or do you feel, discouraged or pessimistic about the future? Have you lost motivation? Do you not enjoy things as much as you might? Those are the five cardinal symptoms of depression, and on any given day, I would say, you know, an awful lot of people are experiencing one or more of those symptoms. I'd say, you know, probably 50-60% of the population struggle with feelings of from time to time of being, you know, inadequate or maybe anxious, public speaking anxiety, shyness. You know, when you quote stats, it's like some real severe thing that people are getting hospitalized for. But really, you know, unhappiness is kind of a human condition that, you know, most of us get struggle with from time to time.
And it seems to be more prevalent today than it used to be. Is that accurate with the way?
I think it's totally inaccurate, total BS. One of the problems is that we haven't had really accurate measuring sticks to measure depression and anxiety until just recently. So it's hard to say that it's changed in the last 100 years or the last 50,000 years, because we didn't know how common it was in those times. I would suspect if you went back 50 million years or whenever it was that the origins of the human race, people were just as down and anxious there, you know, fighting dinosaurs and whatever. I think these things are really a part of the human condition. But whether they're more prevalent now than ever before, I think that's you know, doubtful or just speculation, but they're widespread. Let's put it like that. It's the human condition. I think the Buddha pointed out 2,500 years ago that it's impossible to be happy all the time. I think 100% of human beings pretty much struggle with some kind of you know, excessive depression or anxiety, or for some people goes into the direction of anger and, you know, blame of others too. But it's pretty much the human condition. But you know, I think you can be happy. You know, I think we're all entitled to like 5 happy days per week and 2 miserable days. And if you don't have your 5 happy days, you need a little mental tune-up. And if you don't have your 2 miserable days, we're going to have to put you on lithium because you're getting a little too high.
So what takes it? I mean, you mentioned feeling blue, feeling down. Some days are, you know, the term waking up on the wrong side of the bed. But what takes it from just a normal kind of run-of-the-mill down day to a mood disorder, depressive disorder that is clinical and serious and needs treatment?
Yeah, it's totally arbitrary. It's just a continuum, and you can draw your cutoff point at any point that you want. But I think the difference between normal sadness, like I had I mean, it's probably sound kind of ridiculous, but we adopted this feral cat who came to our back door, and he was a kind of a predator. But I used to chase him out of the yard, but he came to the back because he would, you know, tyrannize our cats. He had grown up in the woods behind our house, and he was a very powerful and aggressive. And then he came to the door one day with held his foot up. I didn't know why he'd come to our kitchen door because he was so afraid of me. And he held his foot up, and it was swollen as big as his head. And I looked at him, and he was emaciated and about ready to die. And I realized he'd been in a fight, and you know, we captured him, took him to the vet. They did surgery, and it seemed like he wanted to adopt us, and we adopted him, and he became my best friend in the world for 8 years. And then he died, or he disappeared about a year ago in the middle of the night. He would go out hunting every night, and probably the mountain lion behind our house got him, or the coyotes. And it was I feel sad, and I loved him so much, more than life itself. And I'll grieve his loss forever, but that's like a celebration. Healthy sadness, you know, shows that you love, that you can engage with life. But the key is when your thoughts become distorted, when you start telling yourself, I'm a loser, I'm no good, I'm a worthless person, this is always happening to me. When you generalize from some negative event, like getting rejected by someone you were dating or someone you cared about, and then you tell yourself, it's all my fault, I'm unlovable, I'll be alone forever. And those thoughts have distortions, like overgeneralization, generalizing from an event to yourself and to all of the future, or all or nothing thinking, looking at things in black and white, like I'm either worthless or worthwhile, I'm either lovable or unlovable, as if shades of gray didn't exist, or hitting yourself with should statements. I should be better than I am. I shouldn't be so screwed up. I shouldn't have made that mistake. Or self-blaming thoughts, or fortune-telling, telling yourself this will never change, or when I get on that plane, I know it's going to crash. When I get in front of the audience, I know my mind will go blank, and I'll make a fool of myself. And it's those distorted thoughts, it's the interpretation of what's happening that causes our emotional pain. And the good news is you can break out of a bad mood, and often quickly, by changing the way you think, by challenging those distorted thoughts and looking at things in a more positive and realistic light. And that's triggered the cognitive revolution that came in around the 1970s, and that's what feeling good was all about. And the last 40 or 50 years of psychotherapy have all been all about cognitive therapy and this cognitive revolution, which really kind of transformed the history of psychotherapy.
We're going to definitely get into more of those automatic negative thoughts, where they come from and what you can do to change them. Before we go any further, we do have a caller. He's been holding for quite a while. He jumped right in at the beginning. So, Eric, you're on line one with Dr. Burns. Go ahead.
Hello.
Eric, you there? Nope, he's gone. Made him wait too long. All right.
Too bad.
Okay. Maybe he'll call back. So in the book, you highlight some of the research that went into studying this. Before you wrote the book, you did quite a bit of research. Can you talk a little bit about the science or the evidence that supports the practices?
Yeah, there's really at least three kinds of research. Number one, when I wrote Feeling Good, the cognitive therapy was unknown. There was only one study that we had done at Penn that showed that it was as effective as the best known antidepressant, and that was what really put it on the map. It was the first form of psychotherapy that had been shown to be as effective as antidepressant medications. Since that time, it's become the most researched form of psychotherapy in human history, and there have been literally thousands of research studies on cognitive therapy. And there's two kinds of research. One is called outcome research, and one is called process research. Outcome research is what kind of treatment produces the best outcome, the fastest recovery. And then process research is, how does psychotherapy work? What are the effective ingredients of all forms of psychotherapy? And can we capitalize on that to develop even more powerful, fast-acting kinds of therapy? So there have been, tons of controlled outcome studies by the National Institute of Mental Health that have shown that cognitive therapy over and over again is as good in the short term as antidepressant drugs, and better than antidepressant drugs in the long term. Another type of research that people don't know about has been on my book, Feeling Good. There have been about 10 studies by the National Institute of Mental Health, or sponsored by them. They were conducted, a lot of them, by research psychologists, including Forrest Scogan at the University of Alabama and his colleagues. And they asked the question, if someone is depressed and you hand them a copy of the book Feeling Good with no other treatment, this is people with major severe depressive episodes, and you tell them you have to go on a waiting list for 4 weeks before you can see your psychiatrist, but read this book in the meantime, what will happen to those people in those 4 weeks? And they've reported that 65% of them recover sufficiently that by the end of 4 weeks, they no longer want or need any kind of treatment for their depression. And they've also done long-term follow-up studies on those patients, well, up to 3 years so far, and have shown that they don't tend to relapse following their initial recovery just by reading the book Feeling Good. And that's the first self-help book that's ever been proven to be effective in treatment. And I would say that the four-week recovery is faster than most psychotherapy or treatment with antidepressant drugs for the most part. But then the process research is what I've done an awful lot of, asking how does psychotherapy work, and we have found a number of ingredients that seem to be the thing that works no matter what school of therapy you belong to or believe in. And so with my colleagues at Stanford, we've developed kind of the next step beyond cognitive therapy that we call team therapy, that's even more, seems to be more powerful and much more fast-acting even than cognitive therapy for depression and for anxiety disorders. And that the big thing now, you see, cognitive therapy is amazing, and it's still amazing. It's how the moment you change these negative thoughts and stop believing these distorted messages, in that instant, you'll get better. But now what we've seen is that therapeutic resistance, motivation, also play powerful roles in the development and maintenance of depression and anxiety. That when you're depressed, a part of you wants to recover, but a part of you may be clinging to the negative moods, clinging to the anxiety, almost afraid to let go of them. And so we've now developed a number of powerful resistance-busting techniques. So we use right away the first time we meet with a patient, and I often see a complete recovery from depression and anxiety the first time I meet with someone in a single session. It has to be a two-hour session. We're experimenting with extended sessions to see if we can primarily complete a course of therapy in one two-hour session, and in many cases that now seems to be possible.
Yeah, that's remarkable. There's some really powerful stories and some great information and techniques in your book, which I read almost 500 pages of it. I didn't quite get through it before this.
Well, good for you. That's ambitious. Way to go.
I only had a couple weeks, so once you agreed. But it was really good, and it really solidified a lot of the things that, and put them into a really good container for me. And I've already started using them to some effect with my clients. So I would recommend any and all therapists read this book.
Oh, I didn't know you were doing treatment in addition to your radio work.
Oh, this is just a side job. I came on. I do this once every 2 weeks, but I am a full-time therapist. So it's been.
Oh, you took after your folks.
Yeah, it's another. I did take after my folks. Yeah.
Oh, that's neat.
All right, let's go to Caroline. She's been waiting for a while. You're on line one with Dr. Burns. Go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Burns. I understand that you've done some great work, and it sounds like the book I'm definitely going to get on the correction of depression. Now, one of the things, I'll preface my question with this little statement. I heard many years ago that the Plains Indians referred to the folks coming across, whites, of course, almost all, I would assume all, as the people who beat their children. So I'm wondering the depression that might come on and the damage that might be done to young children that would recur. And also, I would think that this is, from what I've heard and seen, it's generational. And so, the depression that causes the frustration, that causes the violence and so forth, how long does that take? And does it have physiological impacts? The thing I heard was from a different source, the time that seems to be the worst is the age of 3 to 5. And what can be done? If we value families as much as we say we do in this country, why aren't we doing more, and what can be done to keep depression away, completely,
well,
if possible?
A great question. And again, going back to my earlier mention of our little cat Obi that we adopted, who I love so much, and we have for 8 years. It took some time to develop his trust, because I'm sure he'd had a very abused life, living in the woods, fighting with, there's rattlesnakes and coyotes and bobcats, and he had to fight to survive. And certainly humans who are traumatized will be frightened and terrified as well. It's just common sense. I've been doing a trauma workshop in the United States and Canada for the last several years, a two-day workshop on the new high-speed treatments that we've developed for trauma patients. which involves cognitive therapy as well as some of the new motivational techniques I've been developing in the last five or ten years. And in every workshop, it's a two-day workshop in the evening of day one, I do a live demonstration with a volunteer from the audience who's had severe, horrific trauma or traumas. And I would say I've probably treated 50 severe trauma patients in workshops in the last 2 years or 3 years, and I would say at least 90% of the time there's a complete recovery in 1-2 hour session, roughly. Sometimes it's an hour and a half, sometimes it might be 2 hours and a quarter. And then after that, that means all of the symptoms of depression and anxiety disappear, you know, 100%. And then you have to do some relapse prevention training, which is pretty quick. But I'm encouraged, and this has been true pretty much all of my career, that patients who have experienced severe and horrific traumas have always been the easiest to treat. And one of the things is perhaps that the cognitive model is very liberating, although it's a little threatening to some people, that it's not the trauma that upsets us, but our thoughts about it. And then those thoughts are always distorted, and when you correct the distortions, the negative feelings will rapidly, almost instantly disappear. And what I mean by that is, for example, I showed in Anaheim videos from, with her permission, of course, a woman that I treated who had 30 years of horrific trauma, rape and beatings from a sadistic husband. And she had finally gotten out of the relationship, but was still very, very depressed and anxious and telling herself, I can't trust men, and it was my fault, and I must be defective, and that's why I got beaten, because I'm defective. And of course, those thoughts are extremely unfair and distorted. You know, there's discounting the positive is one of the distortions, all or nothing thinking, self-blame, hidden should statements. And it's usually with trauma patients fairly easy to get them to see through these distortions and to talk back to those thoughts, and when you do, there's a complete elimination of the symptoms, and it's a paradox, because most people say, oh, you know, trauma patients are going to be so hard to treat, but it's my experience is, even before I had these newer motivational techniques, back in the days when I only had cognitive therapy, it was the same thing. The trauma patients were, in my experience, for what it's worth, always the easiest to treat. And what a joy it is, too, to see someone go from horrible suffering to joy, to euphoria. The goal of therapy, in my opinion, isn't to get slightly less depressed, but to get to joy, and so you can wake up and say it's great to be alive.
Yeah, those. Thank you for the call, Caroline. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Those demonstrations that you showed in Anaheim were remarkable, and to watch the shifts in thinking and feeling that happened were quick and very impressive. But one of the things I really want to get to here, and we have callers lining up, but I do want to get to the idea that you mentioned early in the book, that we are ultimately responsible for every thought that we have, and our thoughts create our feelings. I mean, we're so used in our society to say that she made me feel bad, or he did this to me and made me feel bad. But so what is the idea behind nobody can make us feel anything?
External events could never make you feel positive or negative, and I can give an example of it. It's politically incorrect and may enrage some people, but first, the idea goes back to Buddha and Epictetus 2,000 years ago. Said, you know, a Greek Stoic philosopher said, people are not disturbed by things, but by the views we take of them. In other words, only our thoughts can upset you. And then some people say, well, how about, like, you know, something horrible thing, like if you're on a railroad track about to be hit by a train, or when the planes went into the buildings in New York on September 11th. Certainly, that's a horrible trauma that will upset anyone. You don't have to put a thought in your mind, but when you think about it, it wasn't true that everyone who saw those planes go into the buildings felt horrified or anxious or enraged. Some people felt joy, didn't they?
Right.
Like Osama bin Laden.
A different attachment to that event is what you're saying.
Yeah, a different way of viewing it. And they were saying, some people were saying, oh, those Americans, they got what they deserved. This is great. So they felt elated. And so that's a basic idea behind cognitive therapy, that only your thoughts can create your moods. And I've experienced that myself. That's one reason I fell in love with this form of therapy, because it worked for me. And I thought, well, if it'll work for me, it'll work for anyone. But I remember once when I was learning it from Dr. Aaron Beck, and I was asking him about a difficult patient, and then he criticized the way I had talked to the patient about an unpaid bill. And I started to get panicky, and after on the way home, and I started telling myself, my gosh, David, you're a horrible therapist, you're a horrible human being. You know, you said the wrong thing to this patient, you hurt his feelings. And I had all the same kind of negative thoughts that my patients did. I was saying, oh, I'm a loser.
Right.
They're going to get rid of me. They'll take away my medical license. Word is going to spread. I have no skill. And then I went home and I said, oh, gosh, if I've got to run, I probably need to get my brain endorphins up. And so I ran a six-mile loop real fast, a real tough, hilly loop. And the farther I ran, the more depressed I became. And it was like I had seen the ultimate truth about myself. And that's the thing about depression. You're giving yourself these distorted thoughts, but you don't realize how you're fooling yourself. Depression is the world's oldest con. So I finally went home and said, David, write down your thoughts like what you're telling your patients to do, to see if they're distorted. And I said, oh, no, they're not distorted. This is real. And I said, oh, you're whining, just like your patients. Write down your thoughts. See, what are you telling yourself? So I wrote down, I'm a horrible human being. I'm a terrible therapist. They're going to take away my medical license. I have nothing to offer. And then I looked at them written down, and I said, gosh, those thoughts really are distorted. There's all or nothing thinking, overgeneralization, self-blame, emotional reasoning, mental filter, fortune-telling, and then said, how could you talk back to them? And I said, well, why don't I tell myself, you're a student, you're learning, it's okay to make mistakes, that's how you learn and grow. Go back and tell that patient you made a mistake and talk it over with them. Maybe you can turn this into a good thing. And all of a sudden, I felt joyous. I said, wow, this stuff really works. And then the next day, I went and said to the patient, I said, I felt horrible after our session because I really was unskillful and said things that hurt your feelings. And you're probably really angry, and I'm lucky you came back, and let's talk it over. And he was just thrilled and talked it over, gave me an A on empathy, and it was one of the best sessions I'd ever had.
Yeah, it's funny because as I was reading your book in that particular section, I was struck by my own experience where there's a listener who emailed a pretty critical critique of one of my shows, and I couldn't sleep. I was anxious. I thought, they're going to fire me. They're not going to want me to do any more radio shows. And it was despite, in contrast to all the positive feedback I got, which I discounted.
It's incredible and seems so real when it's going on.
Yep. William, you're been waiting for a while. Let's go ahead and get you on with Dr. Burns.
Yes, sir. I'd like to address the national issue with mental illness and gun control. And I've read some articles that basically tell me that it's impossible to control gun manufacturing by gangs. They import them from over the border. They have a whole industry of making guns and shipping them in the United States with fake serial numbers, and it goes on. And about half the households in America have got the equipment to manufacture a gun. But what we need to do is control how people grow up and develop. So why not don't we teach the stuff you're talking about in high school so when people are developing and exploring their world, they got more tools to work with and maybe recognize a problem in themselves or family or friends or someone
I think that can and should be done, and you could be teaching kids about, you know, distorted thinking, even using comic book illustrations of these mental distortions. That, you know, there are some of those that are very good that could even be understood by a first or second grader. And I know when my daughter was in high school, you know, she had a lot of mood issues that were pretty severe, and I persuaded her with my wife's help to let me, you know, kind of help her out a little bit. And you know, one of her things is she thought she was one of the unpopular people. It was one of those all or nothing things, like there are these popular kids who are rich and they know who they all are, and then there's the unpopular kids, and she thought it was like genetic or something like that. And so she thought she was one of the unpopular kids, and she was having a really tough time. And I kept telling her, you know, Senia, I've written a book on how to flirt and how to get boys to chase after you. I have a little book called Intimate Connections, and I said, you know, popularity is just a skill, and I can teach you. And she said, oh, Dad, you don't know what you're talking about, you know, like that. And then my wife said, no, listen to your dad. You know, he really knows what he's talking about. So she sat down and decided to give it a try, and we worked together, and quickly her social life went from rags to riches, and people, you know, it was like an amazing thing. And we, you know, I taught her how to wrap boys around her fingers and not to let boys wrap her around their fingers, and it was so much fun. And but she was so hungry to learn and so quick to learn, it just dramatically changed her life. And we still look back on those days fondly and, you know, laugh together and giggle about how awesome that was. And yeah, I think that we could do a lot, you know, by teaching people about these things, teaching kids about some of these skills at an early age.
Okay, thanks for the call, William. That sounds like a whole show, obviously, in developing skills to teach kids about, you know, I mean, that's an issue that's cropping up, and we're not going to handle that today. But we're at the halfway point in our show, so we're going to go ahead and take a short break. My guest today is psychiatrist Dr. David Burns, who's the author of one of the best-selling self-help books of all time, Feeling Good. Today, we're discussing the use of cognitive behavioral therapy for the treatment of anxiety and depression. If you have a question for Dr. Burns or a comment about today's topic, please don't hesitate to call us. Our local phone number is 550-8433. If you're outside of the Anchorage area, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to participate is to email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll return to our conversation with Dr. David Burns. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in the program, my guest today is psychiatrist Dr. David Burns, who is the author of one of the best-selling self-help books of all time, Feeling Good. Today, we are discussing cognitive behavioral therapy for the treatment of anxiety and depression. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Burns, our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. If you missed part of today's conversation, you can catch the rebroadcast of Line 1 tonight at 8. You can listen to it on our podcast, or you can find it along with all of our past programs in our library of archived shows. Just go to alaskapublic.org homepage, click on the radio tab, and scroll down to Line 1. Please remember, if you're listening to us on Monday night, you'll be hearing a taped recording, and we won't be accepting phone calls. All right, Dr. Burns, what you reminded me of something. I talk to my kids a lot about not giving away their power to other people, and I practice with them little scenarios in which someone's bullying them or targeting them and how they can respond and keep their power. But I'm struck by young kids, and where do these distorted, irrational thoughts, where are they rooted? Because kids don't have the ability to sort of rationalize these thoughts when they're 5, 6, 7 years old. It's just the end of the world. And I'm struck that many of my adults that I work with have those same feelings as if they were still children.
Well, we don't know for sure. It might be genetic. It might just be part of the human condition. Childhood experiences might play a role, and society messages might play a role too. And I would say this is all speculation, but for example, there's a lot of emphasis on perfection in our society, and you know, drive a Lexus and experience the thrill of perfection, and there's a tremendous emphasis on physical attractiveness and sports stars who become tremendously famous and earn tremendous amounts of money, and so we start basing our self-esteem on our achievements or on being loved, and then when you fail, as you know, to my way of thinking, you know, we all fail all the time. You know, life is experiences of failures and successes and learning from them. But we get the idea my worthwhileness as a human being depends on how successful I am or how productive I am or how popular I am or how loved I am. And then you fail or you get rejected, and then you start telling yourself, I'm worthless. I'm no good. You know, something like that. The cognitive therapists believe there's two levels of these negative thoughts. One is the underlying beliefs, the value system. Like a lot of them, I call them self-esteem equations. What you think you have to do or be to be a worthwhile human being. I must be perfect. I must have everyone's approval. I must be a great achiever. I must be loved. That type of thing. And then these 10 cognitive distortions, all or nothing thinking, overgeneralization, mental filtering, mind reading. Imagining others are looking down on you. Fortune telling, should statements, and the idea is that a negative event, like a failure, plus your belief, like I must succeed, leads to feelings of depression and these so-called automatic negative thoughts. But that's just a model. That's just a way of thinking about it. Most of the theories in psychology and psychiatry are false theories. That they're just thrown out there so people have something to believe in that sounds good to them. But I think the great news is that you can turn around wherever these negative, destructive thinking patterns come from, whether it's our genes, our upbringing, society, or from wherever it comes from, there's an awful lot you can do to change the way you think and feel, and it can happen quickly. And what many listeners don't know is that you can successfully treat depression and all of the anxiety disorders in most cases without medications. And I think that's great news.
Yeah, and that's coming from a psychiatrist. You are a psychiatrist with a medical background.
Yeah, I started out doing full-time psychopharmacology and brain research at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, and I had a grant from the federal government to develop a brain chemistry research laboratory at the medical school. I had won awards for my research on brain chemistry. I was handing out antidepressants and other medications by the bucketful, it seemed like, or, you know.
Yeah.
But I knew way back in the mid 1970s that the medications for most patients are not the answer. I've never been against medications. I've prescribed antidepressants personally on more than 10,000 occasions.
Right.
I never recommended them, but if a patient wanted one, I said, okay, I can prescribe this for you, because I was afraid I might get sued if I didn't prescribe one, you know. But most of my patients I treated without medications, and I never saw that much from them, to be honest with you. And, you know, when I was doing my biological psychiatry, I had few patients who were recovering. Really, I was not happy. That's why I turned to psychotherapies, to see if I could find something to help my patients recover. If pills had done it, you know, I never would have gone into learning and developing these new forms of psychotherapy. I would have been happy, give a pill, and the patient's depression disappears quickly. But that sadly doesn't happen. And now the research that's coming out is finally beginning to show a lot of the reanalyses of the data in the Food and Drug Administration is now showing that the chemicals called antidepressants have very few true antidepressant effects above and beyond their placebo effects. And that's a big shock to a lot of people, and very controversial, but the data seems to my eye incontrovertible.
I have done no research studies on the effectiveness of medications, and I'm not a doctor, but what I do see in my office is people who have been on all sorts of medications for years and years and years still struggling with the same issues.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's quite frustrating. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's so obvious. It's frustrating why people can't see this, and why people are put on and kept on drugs that clearly aren't helping them because they're still depressed. And then we have now forms of psychotherapy where, in my experience, most of the time in less than 2 hours, I can make depression disappear completely in a patient. And most people just they don't know that these you know, powerful forms of psychotherapy exist, because they see on TV all these ads constantly for antidepressants.
All right, we have about a 4 or 5 hour show here, but we only have about 17 minutes left. So I'm going to get to a couple more phone calls, and then we're going to go quickly through some information. So, Chris, you're on line one. Can you make your question fairly brief?
Yeah, my question is regarding hormones. I'm a half-breed Alaska native, and, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I never noticed a lot of how the hormones, you know, were negatively affecting me. But now that, you know, I'm older, I'm a grandfather, and I worry about my grandkids, because I see those hormones in them, and I know that they're going to be dealing with that until they're in their mid-20s. And, you know, so do you have any recommendations for, because we're talking about hormones that just make people crazy. I mean, you know, whether you're a girl, if you're a girl, you're going to be boy crazy. If you're a boy, you're going to be girl crazy. You can't focus. You know, you're not able to focus on schoolwork and whatnot. That's what I'm asking about. So, you know, do you have any suggestions for people, you know, that are going to be dealing with that? Because we got whole peoples that have this problem.
Well, Chris, thank you for the phone call. And I would say that off the top of my head, that hormones are a natural biological process that is necessary for development and part of adolescence is navigating through those. Dr. Burns, do you have a response?
No, I would say that's true. Our hormones make us horny. I didn't know what he was talking about at first. Like, I was thinking maybe somehow hormones are causing depression or whatever. But yeah, that's just part of the natural growth. But I would say that in my clinical practice, 60% of my patients didn't know how to get into the dating scene. They were single, they were divorced and couldn't get back into the dating scene, or they were shy or awkward and had never gotten into the dating scene in the first place. And that was one of my favorite things to teach patients, is really how to master the dating scene and to fulfill that part of your life, so you're not always so lonely and horny. And those are things they didn't teach in medical school or residency: how to hustle, how to flirt, how to get people chasing after you, and how to develop really rewarding intimate relationships. And that's been one of the more gratifying areas of my clinical work. But yes, we are all tricked by evolution and our raging hormones into sexuality and things that keep the human race alive, and sometimes it is kind of a pain, the situations we get into.
Yeah, and they drive the intensity of emotions, and kids that are teenagers that are very high and volatile, and so. But I do think it's a necessary developmental, absolutely a
sure.
necessary
and
developmental.
So I only work with people who want help with it. Now, like I have, I wasn't going to mention this because I'm not trying to compete with your fabulous show or podcast. But I, on my website, feelinggood.com, people can go, or on iTunes, they can go and listen to the free weekly Feeling Good podcast, where I not only talk about these new techniques that you're so kindly interviewing me about on your show today, but also sometimes do free actual therapy, live therapy on the show. And in about 2 weeks, we're going to feature live therapy with Daisy, a young woman who's having trouble with pregnancy. And under intense social pressures, messages from society, the woman is supposed to have babies, is supposed to become
right.
pregnant, and she's struggling with intense despair, and that is an issue involving, you know, hormones and sexuality. And so if any of you are interested in hearing how these new techniques can work to bring about extremely rapid recovery, even individuals who are having issues with hormones and, you know, or with anything, really, you might enjoy hearing that. It's touching and powerful and very moving as well. Just go to feelinggood.com.
Yeah, that
blog tab.
That resource is on our website, and I would encourage anybody, because I think a lot of people, Dr. Burns, are going to be very confused, because therapy is supposed to take years, and therapy is supposed to, you know, you be involved and talk about all your feelings and cry and weep. And
yeah.
But now you're claiming and practicing and demonstrating really quick recovery from these things. So I would encourage everybody to go.
I take a lot of flack for it, too, because
yeah.
it's so different from what people are used to believing, and they think I'm a con artist, or it's, you know, they can't grasp it. It's possible. I even teach the psychiatric residents at Stanford, who, you know, young psychiatrists who are learning and getting their licensure and credentials. And you know, I can remember 1 year they just got enraged with me, because they've been taught that depression is like a mountain or something that builds up over years and can only be treated slowly over years.
Right.
And when I'm saying you can sometimes see a complete elimination of symptoms in a single session, they just, you know, kind of didn't like that at all.
Well, I think being a professor at Stanford helps lend some credibility to your claims. So I appreciate
it. Not much. Sometimes the students are very willing to bust you if they don't like what you're saying.
All right. I got two more callers I want to get to real quick, and then I want to
yep.
finish up. Robert, you're on line one with Dr. Burns. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Real quick, I think a lot of what my question was covered over the course of the show, but going back to your story about your daughter and when she was in school, I have a young one. He's young in elementary school, and there's some history of anxiety disorders in our household, and I can start to see him kind of getting anxious about certain aspects of his school life, most pronounced, like, you know, when we're not around to help him out. And I was just wondering if we had any good advice about, you know, how we can teach a young elementary school age kid to take these you know, practices to school when he's not, when he's only around his peer group.
All right, Dr. Burns, how do we teach our children to deal with anxiety and depression?
Well, it's hard to give a quick answer to that on the show, and there's probably a lot of good, you know, resources in terms of books for kids that age. But what we did with our kids and what I do with myself and all of my patients is when they're upset, I say, what are you telling yourself? Let's write these thoughts down, and then you'll see, you know, all the distortions in those thoughts. You know, I'm not good enough, and I'm not smart enough, or I'm not pretty enough, or I can't do it. Yeah.
Nobody likes me.
Yeah. All of that stuff. And if you have a loving, trusting relationship with your kids, and you know, we found they were, you know, very receptive to our help in terms of how to talk back to those thoughts. You might want to, you know, take a look at one of my books, like Feeling Good, and learn, you know, how some of these techniques work and what the different distortions are. That's my quick answer. Can you help me out there, Prentice?
I think we get better at everything that we practice. If you want to learn to play tennis, you practice. If you want to learn to be depressed, this is what I tell my patients, you practice being depressed. You practice being anxious. And the opposite of that is, how do we change our negative cognitions and our negative thinking?
I've developed 50 or 100 techniques to change negative thoughts, but one of the ones that works often with kids is called the double standard technique.
Right.
That, you know, a lot of us operate on a double standard. When we talk to someone else, we're kind and compassionate and realistic, and when we talk about our own flaws to ourselves, we're harsh and mean. And so if you find out, you know, what your son or daughter, what they're telling themselves, write those negative thoughts down, and then you could say, what would you say to a dear friend with a similar problem? Would you say, you're no good, you're not pretty enough, you can't do this? What would you say to him or her? And then would you be willing to talk to yourself in that same compassionate way?
Yeah, the answer is always different when it's a friend or a sister. You know, when you ask your clients, would you treat anybody else the way you treat yourself? Would you talk to them this way? And they say, no, that would be incredibly rude and hurtful.
Exactly.
And so I say, why do you do it to yourself? And
people are like, what would you say to a friend? How would you talk to a friend? And then would you be willing to talk to yourself like this?
Okay, Bill, let's go ahead to another phone call. Bill, you're on line one with Dr. Burns.
I lost a couple cats, and it's different when you can't have closure. One time I held a cat when he died. But the thing, I was watching the Olympics, okay, and I'm watching all these kids who are highly trained falling on the ice. I'm suspecting because they're nervous. Vince Lombardi said winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. These kids are training behind that. How, you probably work with athletes, how do you work with somebody that's competing as opposed to sharing? Because it's kind of hard to be nervous when you're sharing.
Well, I don't have like formulas that I throw at people, but when someone's upset, I always ask, what is it that you're upset about? Can you give me a specific moment that you were upset? What were you thinking? What were you telling yourself? Let's write down those negative thoughts and then see if we can find another way for you to talk to yourself that won't be creating so much tension or anxiety or shame or inferiority.
Yeah, one of the U.S. skaters actually said, and she regretted saying it, but she said it out loud, that her sports psychologist had talked to her about considering it as an audition for Dancing with the Stars, and rather than the Olympic, you know, individual skate. So that's kind of how she approached it or thought of it to sort of calm her anxiety.
Do we have a minute left?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just remembered that I'll disguise the identity, but a man called me from Texas, and I'm going to change the sport and everything to disguise his identity, but he said he was in a terrible panic attack, and nobody could help me. He said he was going to be the number one pick in the NFL draft or the NBA draft or something.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was the top football player in the United States or the top quarterback prospect, something of that type. But he said he was in a panic and no one could help him, and he demanded that I help him, you know, on the telephone. And I said, listen, I'm not in practice, but here's my colleague, Matthew May, who's brilliant. Give him a call, and maybe you can fly up from Texas, and he can give you an intensive for a day or two and help you get over your anxiety. And so it was hard to get the guy off the phone, but he finally agreed to call Matt. He was very demanding and, you know, really in a panic. He was thinking he couldn't perform for the scouts. He was so nervous he couldn't throw a football anymore. And then he talked to my former student, Matt May, and I saw Matt the next day. I said, did you see that guy? Is he going to come up for an intensive? And I said, he's the most anxious person I've ever encountered in my entire life, and he's so demanding. And Matt says, no, I just talked to him for about 3 or 4 minutes. His anxiety completely disappeared. And I said, what in the world did you do? And he said, I just used the techniques you taught me. I told him that I had techniques to make his anxiety disappear, but I didn't think it was a good idea. And then he asked me, he says, well, why isn't it a good idea? And then Matt says, well, I told him your anxiety is your greatest asset. And then the patient said, what are you talking about? And Matt said, well, but you see, that's your perfectionism. And you've been driving yourself ever since you've been a little boy. And I've seen you on TV and how great you are. And the key to your success is your constant worrying. If it weren't for that, you'd just be average. So could I make your anxiety disappear? Absolutely, I could. But I don't think I want to do that. And then the fellow said, oh, thank you, doctor. I feel so much better now. My anxiety just disappeared.
All right, Nancy, you got just a few seconds. Go ahead.
It's hard to follow that one. But my question was, I wanted to ask, what kinds of techniques does he use in order to really make a person's depression or anxiety disappear over the long term after just an hour or two? Doesn't a person need to practice some of the new techniques?
Absolutely.
Absolutely, and then you have to do relapse prevention training. I probably should have explained more on that last example. I apologize. But yes, the person needs relapse prevention training, which means they have to know that your negative thoughts will always come back over and over for the rest of your life. It happens to everyone. No one can expect to be happy all the time. And so each person has a technique that works for them. You know, I've developed 50-100 techniques, but once you find the technique that works for you, it will always work for you. So after that initial recovery, then you have to be coached a little bit. Here's what's going to happen. Here's what you'll be telling yourself when the depression comes back, the anxiety comes back. Let's rehearse talking back to those thoughts right now. And I do that on a tape recorder, on a cell phone, so they record it. And so when those negative thoughts come back, they can just hear that and then pop back out of the episode. But to explain the last call, the reason that sports athlete recovered so fast was called paradoxical agenda setting. We paradoxically showed him that his anxiety was actually a good thing, not something he needed to be ashamed of or to try to make it go away. Uh-huh. Matt tried to talk him into how desirable it was for him to be anxious, and the moment he accepted his anxiety, it disappeared. It's a paradox. That's one of the newer techniques that we've developed just in the last few years here in my group at Stanford.
Well, thank you for the call, Nancy. And Dr. Burns, you got about 10 or 15 seconds to give us closing thoughts.
Well, it's just that a lot of people who are anxious and depressed get hopeless and feel worthless. And my message is one of great hope. I believe that every single human being is capable of great joy and self-esteem and elimination of anxiety. And that's what I hope for every one of our listeners.
Thank you, Dr. Burns. It was absolutely a pleasure to have you on today. Appreciate it.
My privilege. It was a tremendous honor, and I wish you the best. Thank you so much.
All right. Going to the emergency room at night can be a harrowing experience for anyone, let alone young children. On next week's program, Dr. Woodard hosts a discussion about the new Providence Hospital Emergency Department that is devoted exclusively to pediatric care. Eric Bork was our web editor and audio engineer for today's program. This is Prentice Pemberton. Thanks for tuning in today to Line One. Appreciate it. Talk to you next time.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.